Hi everyone, just a quick warning. This week we had a bit of an audio malfunction on my part, which means my audio is a bit scratchy, bit echoey, so I apologize for that. Luckily we've cut a fair few of those chunks out of the episode, so if you get through the first 10 minutes you should be fine, as Adam, Libby and Dave's audio was perfect as always. Again, apologies and hope you enjoy the episode. Bye bye. This podcast is rated S for science and also for spoilers and swearing. There's going to be swearing. No!
It can camouflage! Something is killing these people and sucking them dry.
Run! It's a stampede!
And baby said...
Dance, magic, dance!
Welcome back, everyone, to Cinematic Animalia, your weekly foray into the biology of movie monsters. Today, we are looking at the 1986 Jim Henson / David Bowie extravaganza, Labyrinth. We'll go over some news first. Dave, put your fucking hands down. Tell you a bit about the movie, our thoughts, and then get stuck into the science that this movie brings up, including headless organisms, inverse cuckoos, and what a goblin society might look like as an ecosystem. And then Libby is going to rip apart some puppets and talk about what she finds inside. As always, the show is going to be broken up into a few different segments, so if you've watched this movie and just really want to hear Libby rip apart some of these horrifying puppets, skip ahead to that bit.
Jesus.
Before we get into that, my name is Sam Perrin. I am an invasive ecologist and climate data analyst based in Trondheim, Norway. I also run the website Ecology for the Masses alongside host Adam Harsik, a disease ecologist at the Bourgeois Université of the Negev. It's French, actually. That's why I'm using that sort of pronunciation. Alongside Adam is the Baroness, her ladyship, Libby Young, our story specialist and writer at Short Story Soup. And as always, with us is Dave, a vet and our movie physiologist. In news this week, a bit of personal news, I have finally had two papers published from my PhD, which I'm so happy about.
That's three published total, right?
Three published in total, yeah. The fourth is like an eco-sociology paper that's going to be a lot harder to get published, but at the same time, it's not research that anybody else is rushing to do on this specific like ecosystem, so I don't have to worry about, you know, a bunch of other papers coming out and make it less relevant.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, that's a pain in the ass. Like, even though every paper that, you know, Adam and I have ever worked on is, you know, it's going to be unique in its own way. It's going to have its own special aspect to it. You can't help but get annoyed when a paper comes out that's very similar to yours.
You can also get scooped, which is a very real concern.
Yeah. It's like, does this diminish the importance of my paper? Maybe not in the long term, but it feels like it does. You know?
Yeah.
And it's a silly feeling, because the fact is that there's so many scientists working on this sort of stuff all over the world, and there should be. You know, we need multiple brains in multiple ecosystems working on, you know, similar problems, but it does suck that you're just like, oh, this is almost exactly what I've done. Oh, they beat me to it.
There are also some researchers who, like, that's their entire thing. Their entire lab is dedicated to doing the same experiment with slight modifications or slight changes in 30 different ways, and that's what they like to do. It's not my favorite thing, but some people like it.
And this is where I put a trophy. If I had one! Sorry, what's the happy?
There's a PhD student here at the Bourgeois University, that one, who researches, her specialty is the ibex here, but she got sucked into a side project that became a chapter in her PhD, which is something that happens to all of us often, and she's been studying the impact of human hikers or human presence on the presence or absence of native fauna, so the native animals. So she first started by going out to these areas where hikers aren't allowed, that are kind of managed by the Israeli Parks Authority, and quantifying how many hyena, how many Arabian wolves, gazelle, ibex, and foxes, all those kinds of different animals, how many there are, the different species, what have you. Then she's been bringing groups of volunteers to go on hikes for 1 kilometer stretches, back and forth, two or three times a day, either every other day or at least a couple times a week for a couple months now. And she's been quantifying how much that's been impacting. And just from her brief little foray of starting this without even analyzing the data, just like eyeballing it, she can tell that animals are not showing up near as often as they did when she first started. So it was really interesting for me to hear, like, even in these more remote areas where hikers probably aren't going all the time, we really have an impact on the movements and the behaviors of these local animals.
Which is why I get really annoyed when people are like, well, if we let wolves back into the country, how do we keep them away from us?
You walk around, yeah.
Yeah.
Not that hard.
You keep existing where you're existing, and they won't come. Unless you live in a small town in Siberia, in which case a super pack of 400 wolves will descend upon your town in the middle of winter, and they'll have to, I think, bring in the Russian version of the National Guard to try to save them.
Is that a movie?
That's a real thing that happened.
Really?
Really.
Okay.
What is the name of the town?
I thought you were, you know, making a comparison to our 30 Days a Night.
Yeah. I was going to bring this up during the 30 Days a Night episode, but we moved past it. Yeah, in the winter of 2010 to 2011, a super pack of wolves numbering up to 400 reportedly terrorized the Russian town of Verskoyensk, population 1300, in the northern region of Yakutia, one of the remotest inhabited areas in the northern hemisphere.
Yeah. Okay.
Wow.
All right, and lastly, just quickly, we want to... What's the opposite of a retraction, when you have to insert something into
insertion.
A paper?
An insertion.
An insertion.
Correction.
We did Dune last week.
Dune.
And Adam, as a damselflyologist, forgot to talk about the fact that the...
Ornithopters.
The ornithopters were clearly modeled after either damselflies or dragonflies. So, quick review, what did you think of them?
Beautiful. However, in the books they're called ornithopters, and ornith coming from the word for bird, not odinotology, yeah. Not odinothopter, which would make a lot more sense.
Yeah. Odinothopter?
Odopter.
Odopter,
yeah.
They're fantastic. I love the design.
Do you think this was, you know, one of those things where they sat down and said, do we think most people know what an ornithologist is?
No, I think they just looked at it and thought, well, we could have a plane that flaps its wings, and that looks fucking stupid. Or we can take this thing that looks like a dragonfly, which looked badass. And if you could make those kind of vibrating wings work for something that large, it would be it would make for a really powerful flyer, because dragonflies are some of the most... powerful and skillful flyers on the planet. They can fly in any direction. Each of their wings moves independently. They can hit 23 Gs in a turn. Like, they are really talented.
As a writer, Sam, to answer your question, I would say about 85% of writers or directors just say, does that shit sound or look cool? Done.
Discount Snickers get made chuffed.
Well, you've heard of the evil stepmother, but have you heard of the evil stepdaughter? Sarah, a young girl that acts half her age, is asked to babysit one night while her parents take a break from spoiling her ass. Even though she has zero social life and hangs out with her stuffed animals, Sarah is so livid that she was asked to help out that she literally gives her half-brother away to an evil sorcerer and his army of goblins that she 100% already knows is bad news. Then she quickly changes her mind after it's too late, and must solve a puppet-filled hallucinogenic labyrinth to save her baby brother from the peril that she put him in. Along the way, she makes some friends, I guess, who I predict are so abused and gaslit from the king that makes this piece of work seem like a peach. She, I'm putting air quotes around that, also solves the labyrinth. No, she doesn't. After some creepy sexual subtext about womanhood, she finally rescues her brother from the Goblin King's castle just in time for the parents to return.
And then has a giant ass kick-ass dance party at the end.
With the psychopath Fieries.
I also have an alternate summary. It's very brief.
Yeah.
Alternatively, this is about a young girl who has some clear behavioral and possible mental issues that her parents so clearly ignore as a result of stigmatized society, so they endanger her and their infant by placing her in charge of a situation she is incapable of handling in order to have a date night.
Yes.
Yeah.
For 1980s America, I think that's very fair.
Yeah, I think you and I should go first this week too, because we fucking hated this, and then Adam and Dave go last when it comes to it, so that, you know, we finish on a high note.
What did you like?
In terms of what I liked, there were some really interesting visuals in here. For the hand scene, I thought was really cool.
The helping hands.
I thought that was a really good way of, you know, just making a cool visual effect out of nothing, really. And I liked the representation of M.C. Escher's staircase. And the kind of hopelessness of it that induced in the scene. The one character I liked was Didymus.
Sir Didymus.
Sir Didymus.
Sir Didymus.
Yeah. And there were some funny lines.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What do I love? I like the potential for this movie. I like the concept. I do. I am a huge fan of any type of story or movie that has some sort of fantastical reality attached to a existing reality. So I like the fact that you kind of like don't know if it's real or if it's, you know, a fantastical imaginings or whatever. So I appreciated the thought of this movie.
Adam?
Okay.
I think Sam's comment about the hopelessness of the Escher staircase kind of, that's the feeling I was getting from this entire movie. This entire labyrinth is really set up to make you fail. And I feel like the visuals, the tone, like that first time where she like looks out the window and it like goes back and she's standing in like this weird yellow sunset, spooky dead trees behind her. Like, it's very dark, but in like a, I don't know if this is a too North American centric reference, but it makes me feel like October in the US when I was a kid, of like watching Sleepy Hollow and seeing like the leaves changing and everything has like kind of that spooky, creepy vibe, but not in like the overt Halloween way, just a very autumn, scary way. And I think this entire thing is just really, really set against her. And it would be a horrible place to be. And I thought the movie really did a good job of communicating that. And I obviously didn't watch this when it came out because I was minus 4 years old. But I also get this weird feeling of nostalgia from it that I obviously don't have because I didn't watch it until I was 26 for the first time. So for whatever this movie has, it makes you feel that even if you didn't have it to begin with. And I really appreciated that.
Yeah. And I can understand how nostalgia would help a lot with this film.
100%. So, and, of course, I love David Bowie.
I've been watching this movie since I was a kid, like yearly. We had the old VCR copy.
It's just been on loop in the background ever since he was like 5 years old.
I can see the box in my head that was like all frayed by the time we finally had to give the VCR, like the tape away because we'd pretty much like worn it out. I love the juxtaposition that takes place between it being simultaneously terrifying and also hilariously incompetent, where you see like the big drill that goes by and it's just like four goblins on the back like running the little like thing to try and keep it going. You see them like look at it as they pass and they're like, oh well, fuck. Or even the like giant scary robot, and they like pull the helmet off and it's the little guy inside and he's like, fuck off, like I'm at work here. There was stuff I didn't like. I rewatched this last night, and I think stuff that I missed when I was a kid that I caught as an adult. So the garbage lady puppet, when she's piling all the stuff onto our lead, she's trying to make her into like another garbage woman where she's just like, oh, you need to take everything that you need. Mm-hmm. Like, it's all about possessions. And she's like piling all that stuff onto her chair. She was great. And the facial expressions, the puppets, I love this movie. I love David Bowie.
I was going to say, then you got to think about, if she's doing that to our lead, then what is her story?
Yeah. Yeah. She's a fucking...
very spooky.
She has a saw hanging off her bag that once, like, I saw, I could not unsee that every time she turns, like, there's just a saw hanging there. And I'm like, wow, she's
so fucked up childhood she must have had.
Yeah. I think it's just really bad hoarders. I think it's the ultimate hoarder if you have to take everything with you.
I hate to say this about the cat lady, but I think she's crazy. She's a hoarder.
So on to what we didn't like. Very quickly, three things. I hate the aesthetic of this movie. I hate the way the puppets look. I hate the way everything looks, but that's just personal. But this felt like something was going to kick in to make it more magical any second. This felt like an episode of The Mighty Boosh. And I know The Mighty Boosh takes a lot from David Bowie, but this felt like that without any of the fun, without any of the warmth. And look, Jennifer Connelly became a great actress, but clearly it was some point after this movie. But my main thing is that David Bowie is fantastic, but he is wasted here. He is so oddly restrained. He never feels like he gets out of bed. Like, he doesn't feel like he's alive or awake. You have this larger-than-life icon. And, I mean, okay, so the best example is the scene where he's singing Dance, Magic, Dance. He doesn't look like that, you know, rock star dancing around. He looks like a kindergarten teacher on an off day. Maybe they're hungover, having to dance with the students.
That is so accurate. It really hurts, but I have to agree to it.
It really is.
In his defense, he's just acting against puppets. And I know a lot of actors have struggled with that. Where, like, you don't have another human. You're just in a room surrounded by puppets. And you're like, you have to act against these.
Also, in his defense, he's not an actor. He's a musician. There was a review that I read when this came out. And one of the critics said, I would say David Bowie is wooden, but I think plastic would be more accurate. What do I dislike about this movie? Everything. Absolutely everything. I think, to reiterate some of Sam's points, I hate the aesthetic. I hate the way the goblins look. I just personally, that's not how I imagine goblins looking. I think that the music is severely lacking. Like, none of the songs make sense with the story. None of the song lyrics make sense at all. And I think, to me, it could have used more. You know, there's only like 5 songs in this, and I think two of those were like credit songs. You know, so I feel like this movie just had some potential, and then it just got lost in its own labyrinth.
Yeah,
I see what you did there.
But yeah, on the note of the musical thing, it felt like the more recent Jungle Book, not Mowgli, the one that came before that, where there's 2 kind of songs in there. And when they come in, just like, is this a musical? Yeah. Could they decide? Yeah.
Is this
a... yeah.
It's kind of like the new Lion King.
I remember what I was going to say. So I don't have anything against puppets, because I really like a lot of the Muppet movies. So it's, to me, this isn't like an anti-Jim Henson thing. I think I watch Muppet Christmas Carol every year. That movie is fucking hilarious. And I feel like this wasn't Jim Henson in a lot of ways. Like, there was a lot of the humor was missing. I feel like a lot of the aesthetic, like, everything was very much like where Adam's living right now. Like, everything was brown and like, just like, it was missing a lot visually for me that I really enjoy out of the Muppets. And it just, yeah.
It's so good.
I've only seen that. This is the only second time I've watched this movie. First time being when I was 26. And I don't think it really sank in until they pointed out to me off in a private conversation about how little music there is and how much I really now wish that there was more David Bowie, just David Bowieing it up. Like, he was a hell of a performer for a good reason, because he was super talented, and it would have been a lot more fun to have him really just chew the fucking scenery this entire movie. I think the only other thing I don't like about this movie is the weird sexually charged scene at the end with David Bowie and Jennifer Connelly. She could be his very young daughter, and I don't like that weird dynamic going on.
She is 14 in this movie, by the way.
Yeah, thankfully, it's not like the entire movie, but that part at the end, I just always remember thinking, what the, why? What is happening?
The fiery still freak me out. And they're, I remember horrifying. Watching this movie as a kid. And like, yes, I understand the green screen goes really bad during their dance scene, which it
inexcusably
does.
Bad.
Yeah. But I also have this memory locked in my head as a kid of watching this when the fireys are like, we need to pull your head off. And they're trying to like catch her and potentially pull pieces off, and having this feeling of dread wash over me every time I watched it until she finally gets out of there. And rewatching it last night, I had the same fear. Like, I watched some terrifying horror movies, and I still think that that scares me the most, where they're like chasing her through the woods and she finally gets to the rope where she can escape. And all that kept going through my head the entire time was run, as my heartbeat exceeded the 200s.
I always love kids movies, or movies that you watch as kids that are horrifying, that aren't meant to be horrifying. Like, for me, mine, I watched in 5th grade in theaters, I watched Mars Attacks. And that movie gave me the worst nightmares for years. I was convinced that these aliens were going to come down my street, and I was like, am I going to be a red skeleton or a green skeleton?
People of Congress!
Trivia-wise.
The trivia that I have, this is actually the last feature film that Jim Henson ever directed, and it was considered a box office failure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
Literally, the only thing I have is that Frank Oz is in this, but he's not Hoggle. Which blew my mind. I saw Frank Oz. I heard Hoggle's voice. I was like, oh, it's Frank Oz. No, it's not.
Nope. The "you remind me of the babe" line is a direct reference to an exchange between Cary Grant and Shirley Temple in the 1947 film The Bachelor and the Bobby Soxer.
The Bobby Soxer?
It's like a baseball thing.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
Your favorite scene, Sam. So the shaft of hands is what it's called. Took
shaft of hands.
Give a guess how many live hands or performers that was.
30?
75 performers or 150 live hands, and then 200 foam hands in addition.
Wow.
That's a lot of hands.
For the helping hands. Yeah.
That came in very useful.
And then the last bit of trivia I have is that it actually took 2 years to complete a final script that was ready for shooting. Basically, there was a bunch of back and forth with this movie. So only one writer is actually credited. There were about 6 script writers in total from start to finish that worked on this film. Mm. At one point, the script was sent to Bowie for approval, and he considered dropping out as a result because he thought it wasn't, like, funny enough. And then an early ending for the movie in, like, pre-script was Jareth entering Sarah's home disguised as the author of the play she is seen performing at the beginning of the movie, snatching her baby brother away against her will, demanding that he'd rather have a queen than a goblin prince. Sarah kicks him away in disgust, and he loses his powers and turns into a goblin.
Jesus.
Hmm. Yeah.
Weird.
Well, there's still flavors of that original ending in the ending of this movie.
Well, and the other replacement actor that they had considered playing David Bowie, and it was a toss-up right before they started filming, was Michael Jackson, which would have aged a lot poorer.
They had a ton of well-known actresses that read for Sarah's role as well, like Sarah Jessica Parker, Helen Bonham Carter,
Jane Krasinski.
Yeah, there was a ton, a huge long list of them.
Yeah, Jane Krakowski, Sarah Jessica Parker, Marissa Tomei, and Laura Dern.
Yeah,
Laura Dern. Wow.
Yeah.
And cool. Adam, to answer your earlier question, Bowie did not do his own crystal juggling stunts. They had a choreographer, Michael Motion, who actually juggled the balls without looking, hidden behind David Bowie by sticking his hands underneath Bowie's armpits.
I figured that's what was happening.
He became kind of a puppet.
That orphan kid with a therapy puppet might as well head on back to his group home, because the ventriloquy slot is yours!
So, before we get stuck into the science, if you've got any thoughts or questions, you can find Adam and I on Twitter. I am at Big Dr. Fishboy. Adam is at Harsic Adam. If you want to get in touch with the podcast, you can visit the website, cinematicaanimalia.com, or email us at cinematica.animalia@gmail.com. You can also chat or game with us on Discord. Just type in Cinematica Animalia and you'll find us. If you want to read Libby's work, you can visit shortstorysoup.substack.com and sign up for fortnightly emails with new stories. And if you want to hear some of the less movie-related ecology that Adam, I, and a large team of international writers write about, check out ecologyforthemasses.com.
Yeah, so obviously a focus of mine, because the fiery scared the crap out of me and continue to scare the crap out of me, was the concept of a creature living without a head. Which is a common thing. They're pulling off their hands and whipping them into the fire and doing other crazy crap. But they constantly pull their heads off, and they even seem to have a code where you're allowed to pull off your own head and throw it, but you're not allowed to pull off somebody else's head and throw it, because they get really mad at her about that. There are a couple of different species that can survive without a head. And the absolutely most terrifying one that I did not know about was the Miracle Mike. So do you guys know about this?
I know about Magic Mike.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I know Magic Mike.
Is this the chicken, Dave?
Yeah, this is really dark. So 1946, a farmer who was attempting to get a chicken to cut, or for his dinner, ended up trying to chop the chicken's head off with an axe. He ended up removing the bulk of the head, but he missed the jugular vein, left one ear and most of the brainstem intact. The chicken, that was non-visual, was able to walk clumsily, and the farmer decided to keep him. He fed the chicken a mixture of milk and water via an eyedropper with small corn grains for food. The chicken survived for almost actually a year and a half and used to earn the farmer, who sent pictures of it and updates, $4,500 per month. This is a lot of money. Absolutely an act of animal cruelty. Only look the pictures up if you want to haunt your dreams.
It is. It's grotesque. I would advise not looking this shit up. Yeah.
Sorry, David. I always find these things interesting, so I just wanted to say $4,500 in 1946 is like making $63,300 a month.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, so the farmer was obviously upset when it died.
I bet the chicken was too. It lost most of its head.
Now, the more interesting subject here that I was just going to branch off into, because there was a video that was circulating on Reddit for a while with a fly pulling its own head off. And a group of people, like the fly is seen juggling its own head. This is a thing. So flies, when they have their head removed, can actually continue to walk, move around for days, even weeks. And the reason they can do this is because of where their nervous system is split up. So you and I have, you know, big responsibilities that are associated with our brain when it comes to its regulation of respiration, as well as our other normal function. Flies and other small insects have a greater split up. So unlike humans, the central nervous system of flies is actually split up into different categories. So it's composed of the brain, the inferior throat ganglion, and the abdominal nerve cord. The brain is responsible for midline sensation and connection and plays a role in coordination and inhibition of behavior, but its functions are relatively simple compared with our brain. The inferior throat ganglion is responsible for the activity of the mouth parts, and basically it's just responsible for eating. But the ventral nerve cord, so the abdominal nerve actually plays the big roles that are associated with respiration and sort of the functions that are associated with life. So the fly doesn't stop breathing when its head's gone. So it continues to go. The only reason that the fly will eventually die is because losing its head means it loses its mouth. Yep. So if these creatures actually have separate connections that are associated with their body in terms of where their connection points are taking place, and there's a larger role played for sort of a secondary brain somewhere else in the tissues, they might be able to survive for a period of time once the head is removed. That's not going to happen. There's a reason that we regulate our brain into these big functions. It really wouldn't take place. And regardless, theoretically, by pulling their heads off, these guys are going to kill themselves because they're not going to be able to eat anymore.
Or put them back on.
Unless somebody feeds them with an eyedropper and small amounts of corn.
That's gross. Yeah. That section was a lot more unsettling than I thought it would be.
Just like the fieries. Who, like, real quick, another thing I don't like. That song they're singing is so fucking hard to hear because their voices are so quiet relative to the music. And it's just like, what is happening?
But I wanted to, as in opposition to Dave, talk about the one character that I did like from this, which was nice. Ludo. Oh, no, I like Didymus as well.
Yeah,
I like Didymus.
I like Ludo, but the moment I saw him, I was like, that is a Gigantopithecus. But anyway, the Gigantopithecus is relatively recent. This is a massive ape that went extinct only about 100,000 years ago. So Homo sapiens, we coexisted with them at the same time. Terrible. They were, mainly Southeast Asia. They were found throughout southern China, Vietnam, that sort of area. They're part of the Pongonae, which is the subfamily that the orangutans belong to. So their closest living relatives are orangutans, which is why when you see artist depictions of them, they're often, you know, depicted as these huge, big, hulking orangutans, kind of like Ludo, which is why when I looked at it, I was just like, oh, okay, cool. They've kind of, you know, done a take on a Gigantopithecus. If people have seen the recent interpretation of The Jungle Book, again, bring that one up, not the Andy Serkis version, the other one, Christopher Walken's version of King Louis is depicted in that movie as a Gigantopithecus. Gigantopithecus were, like I said, about 4 meters tall if they had stood up fully. Normally, they're depicted as having walked around on their knuckles, like gorillas do, but they were about twice the size of modern gorillas. And the really interesting thing that I find about these animals is that they're a great example of how much we have extrapolated about the physiology and the behavior and the looks of certain prehistoric animals based on next to nothing. So all we have of Gigantopithecus in terms of fossils are jaw bones and molars, molar teeth. That's it. The first one was actually found, I believe it was a molar that was found in a Chinese drugstore back in the 1930s by a German paleontologist who was just fishing around because he knew that a lot of these teeth, which were called dragon teeth at the time, teeth from extinct animals were kept and were like used as a kind of a herbal remedy. Oh. By people back in the day. I don't know if it's still a common practice. But yeah, he just found one in a Chinese drugstore back in the 1930s. And he was like, hey, I'm buying this because it belongs to an extinct animal. It looked exactly like a gorilla's or an orangutan's molar, but it was like twice, three times the size.
Wow.
And we have been able to tell from dietary analysis that these things are closely related, well, closely related in terms of belonging to the same subfamily, to orangutans. But like I said, all we've got is a jawbone and some teeth. And so we've extrapolated this entire image of what they are and how they behaved by pretty much nothing more than some dietary analysis and this one part of the body, which I just think is really cool. It doesn't mean that those things are inaccurate. I think it's more a testament to what we know, what we can tell about species, not know perhaps, but what we can tell about species from so little information.
It's always fascinating to me.
Yeah. And I mean, it may have looked completely different. The reason it's often depicted by artists as looking like an orangutan is because it's all we've got to go on, really.
That's what we know.
We believe that Gigantopithecus went extinct about 100,000 years ago just because they were quite specialized and they couldn't put up with a constant shifting of the temperature between ice ages. Habitat change, which coincidentally is what's driving lots of orangutans extinct today.
The film opens in a great scene I don't think I paid all that much attention to when I was younger, too. Of Hoggle walking through and just blasting these fairies with various poison. I'm also not exactly sure. It doesn't look like the garden is super well taken care of as well. It's not like he's maintaining this beautiful space, so I feel like he's just blasting.
You don't know what type of ecosystem he's going for. Just because he doesn't have a fucking green lawn doesn't mean it's not a legit garden, Dave. God damn.
Fair enough.
What was it that Adam said? Are you a 16th century French lord? No, so fuck off. Those are Adam's exact words.
Yeah. Sounds like me.
Regardless.
More like bloody regardless. I'm going to mute myself.
When the fairy gets picked up by Jennifer Connelly, she responds by being like, "The fuck? Like, it bit me." Which I think is an interesting point for our ecologists in terms of having these ideas that if an animal like looks a certain way, it's got to be nice or lovely or friendly, which Sam loves to remind us is not the case with ducks.
Dolphins or otters or
seals.
But just out of curiosity, because it always sort of freaks me out, I went back and I started doing my reading about the different types of toxicity and sort of how it works. So most of the insecticides that we use that come in spray cans that would be aerosolized like that, they work by basically blocking off various types of voltage-gated channels when they hit wasps, insects, whatever you may blast it on, which causes these animals to experience hyperexcitability states. They'll basically seize or tremor themselves to death. Not a great way to go. Now, these toxicities have also become important in terms of their use in other species. We bring them up all the time for like pyrethrin toxicity associated with cats. You've got to be really careful with your topical medications that you use to protect your dog against flea or tick. If it gets onto your cat, it can trigger hyperexcitability states where they can seize and die. Now, the point that I thought this was so interesting is basically Hoggle blasts these poor fairies with this high dose of this material, which is going to cause them to tremor to death. And then Jennifer Connelly seems shocked when it bites her. Fuck you. All right. Like, if I'm going to seize to death, I definitely do not find it surprising that the fairy bites the human at the end. Good job, fairy. Get one last one in.
But yeah, I mean, it is another one of these things where, you know, you go to another culture and all of a sudden one animal that you find, you know, very cute and cuddly is something that they absolutely revile.
My teacher tells me real beauty's on the inside.
That's just something ugly people say.
The centerpiece of this movie is kind of, you know, the Goblin King kidnapping a small child, and the veiled threat is that it will be, you know, raised as a goblin.
Become one of us.
And become a goblin. Yeah. And, I mean, maybe the first thing that might come to minds when, you know, the first thing that might come to people's mind when thinking about this is, you know, something like a cuckoo, a different animal of a different species that is raised amongst other chicks. So this is kind of like an inverse cuckoo, I guess, as opposed to, you know, the bird forcefully putting its egg in someone else's nest is being stolen, which does happen within species. But the kind of impression we're given here is that the goblins and humans are very different creatures. But I mean, even so, a cuckoo doesn't grow up to look more like the host species at all.
No.
So that doesn't really work in this case. But gene expression is a tricky thing. We've spoken a little bit about it before. Adam is a little stronger in this, but neither of us are great when it comes to, you know, genomics or anything like that. But two individuals with the same DNA can grow up to look very different, or at least noticeably different, based on where they grow up. We talk about nature versus nurture. It's always a combination of the two. You can plant a tree in one area and in an area, you know, 1,000 meters higher in terms of altitude, and the one on the ground might come out and flourish and be, you know, 4 meters tall. The one 1,000 meters above might have, you know, higher oxygen needs and therefore might come out kind of stunted and look more like a large bush than anything else. So you could have that sort of thing happen in this situation. You could very easily have a human that grows up in a situation where it is malnourished, it's treated poorly, it has many broken bones growing up.
Yeah.
And as a result, its growth is very stunted. If you've got a goblin king who's walking around just kicking the shit out of you all the time, sorry, you're probably not going to grow up with the healthiest body out there. Your skin could turn out absolutely terrible. Could be pallid, could be sunken. It could take on a different tone depending on what you're exposed to, depending on how often you shower.
How jaundiced you are.
Exactly, yeah. And your hair could turn out terrible and gross, and yeah, all sorts of things could happen. So just because a species has human DNA doesn't mean it's necessarily going to grow up to look a lot like we do. However, it would still be the same species. It's not going to be a different species.
No.
So potentially all the goblins are just that, you know, very malnourished, poorly taken care of humans.
With mild signs consistent as well with low-grade radiation toxicity. Their skin kind of falling in, all of their hair gone. If it turns out the castle has, like, yeah.
And it's just David a plutonium mine underneath.
Yeah, that's that. That is, David Bowie needs those little child hands to get in there and get the bricks that he sells to other countries.
Yeah.
It also makes it really dark. I was rewatching it last night and I was like, oh, like, none of the goblins die throughout this. And then there's the one goblin machine gun cannon who's like firing, who Ludo like summons the rock for, and then it like falls on his head. So that would imply that they've just crushed a abused, malnourished, brainwashed former child.
Yeah,
potentially.
This isn't a happy film by any stretch of the imagination.
No. I was going to say, if you guys are familiar with Changeling lore, I think that this movie really encapsulates that. So if you're not familiar with Changeling lore, generally in the Celtic countries, but they're kind of all over, there's even some in different countries in Africa, where there is goblins or fairy people, fairy folk that steal a human child, take it away to their realm. It's often said they do this to strengthen their genetic line. And then they exchange, sort of like brood parasitism, they exchange that human child for a changeling. So you have a goblin or fairy that takes place, and then they grow up in the human realm. And in medieval times, this was often a really bad thing because people were put to death because they were accused of being changelings. They now know that these kids were likely suffering from some sort of disorder, disease, or autism. And so people didn't know what that was and just said, yeah, that's fairy folk. So this person isn't my baby, put them to death. And it was a pretty sad thing. In the lore, it is said that they weren't always necessarily fairy children or goblin children, but actually old fairy folk that took the place of the child, which is why they like grew up stunted or shriveled, or often depicted bearded as well. So
Okay.
I now understand Hoggle's hatred for the fairies.
Yep.
Yeah. But transitioning to the Bog of Eternal Stench, which rewatching it, still a great concept. Love that idea. You get dipped in it, you're just going to like stink forever. And I love how that's the thing that like all of them fear. It's not like some horrible death coming in or anything along those lines. They're just like, fuck, man, if this guy gets us, we're going to smell bad for forever.
Except Dedimus, who can't smell anything.
Yeah. That's right.
Right, or the fact that they are, when they're walking on those stones, like Ludo is full on barefoot touching the bog. Like the stones come up. There's definitely bog juices on there. He is going to have the worst feet for all time. Now, in terms of bogs, and this is something I just felt that I knew Adam and Sam were going to jump in. Wetlands are really cool, but they oftentimes get associated with their poor smell. The concept is just simply recycling. There's a lot of organic material that basically gets brought into wetlands.
Yep.
And that dead plant material or animal waste or whatever it might be, there's collections of bacteria and fungi that are basically breaking down all of those compounds. Mm-hmm. And they release series of gases as byproducts. They are essential to basically allowing for recycling to take place inside of the natural world and for this material to get broken down. And the nutrients that they produce help the soil to be restored sort of downstream. Now, what I hadn't realized is apparently the bacterial and fungal populations are really unique to the different bogs. And so there are wetland scientists that discuss that you can tell like which type of bog it is and where it is based on the smell of the gas that's being produced.
It's
so cool. I also love the idea of like a group of ecologists like taking a whiff of something and being like, yeah, that's Southern California right there.
They have like little snifters of each type of bog.
Yep.
But the distinction between like different types of, not even different types of bogs, people think of bog, fen,
marsh, swamp,
marsh as like synonyms, but they're not. They're all very different types of wetland. Like I think some of it has to do with acidity and other aspects of it have to do with biodiversity.
It's acidity, it's trees, it's the potential of the species as well. Because I think a swamp has trees, a bog does not. Somewhat. And then like the fen and all that factors into the pH.
But I do love the idea of just this labyrinth has a bog in it. And these undereducated, broken, malnourished, lost children are just like, that place stinks, man. I don't want to go in there. And like they don't bathe. And we don't see any other water sources. So yeah, theoretically, if you walk through the bog, you're just going to be smelly for the rest of it. But yeah, I mean, in terms of, I thought that was a cool little reference. And we love talking about wetlands and marshes. Please do what you can to protect them if you do donate, and please encourage activities in your neighborhood that look to protect these areas. It's something that's becoming a bigger point in Canada to try and protect and preserve, and it's really cool.
They are crucial. So this movie isn't like a lot of the movies we've done where there's like one main monster or type of species we're dealing with. This is weird alternate world dimension area where you have a goblin king in quotations that's literally David Bowie, not even the crazy thing he has is like cat's eye makeup, and it's just a dude that is in charge of these goblins. And I think what's going on is some strange kind of interspecific society, interspecific being groups of different species living and working or interacting with each other in a beneficial way. So you can have superorganisms, which we've talked about many times before, be those ants, termites, what have you, where all of these individuals of the same species work together to fulfill a certain goal, be that taking care of the queen, she reproduces, everyone's fitness then goes up. But these are all, I think, different species, and maybe not necessarily adopted children that have now started to look like goblins. But you have the Fieries that have been kicked out. You have Ludo, who is this big Australopithecus. Is that what it was, Sam? Gigantopithecus?
Gigantopithecus,
yeah. Australopithecus is a hominid.
Yeah.
But all of these different, I mean, there is a culture to this. Right? I mean, Jareth is a king of these individuals. There's like soldiers and all that, but I don't want to go into the culture side of it. But I think we have different species fulfilling different tasks. There's guards at the doors. There's soldiers that are running around trying to corral people and patrol. There's servants who are bringing things here and to and from. There's the Goblin King himself, Jareth, who seems to be in charge of everything. There's those small creatures that are in the maze that are lifting up the flagstones and flipping them over and confusing Sarah or potentially any other person that comes to the labyrinth.
Don't forget about the creatures who spend their entire life stuck on a stick while other people like push them towards chewing on other creatures.
Or the waste floor. I love that concept. Or junk ladies.
Yeah. Oh, I'm getting to that one. I forgot about the soldiers, though. Of why have a spear when you can put a big, blind vampire rat at the end of it with these massive fangs to just bite everybody, which is hilarious.
It's a great scene.
Yeah, what are either amensalists or parasites. Amensalists being an organism that either lives on or within another organism that doesn't take anything from them, but it gets a benefit, and the host individual also doesn't suffer a fitness cost. And I don't know how common those interactions are in nature, but there is a definition for it. So they might be in a mensalist. That being the caterpillar at the beginning of the maze, it keeps trying to invite Sarah in for a cup of tea with Mrs. But it might also be a parasite, because we don't know what cost that caterpillar or other individuals like himself or themselves is taking. Maybe the fairies as well. Those could be parasites because they seem to be a pest species, but they might also just be like micropredators, like a mosquito. We have the trash lady who collects and maybe sorts refuse. She might do something with it. She might serve the purpose of bacteria in the bogs, and maybe she helps break down and sort these things, and maybe like a weird organic recycling type process is going on there. But you also have, like you do with superorganisms, they tend to ostracize or kick out problematic individuals. Ants are known to remove, or ants that are sick are known to stay out of the hives. They don't infect the rest of the hive. So the potential crazy ostracized individuals are obviously the fieriest because they're fucking lunatics. Why would you ever want those in your society? They're insane. They're dangerous. They're trying to kill people. They're lighting things on fire. I would definitely kick them out of my society. But then you have other outcasts like Ludo and Sir Didymus. They maybe are either working with or against this interspecific society. And so that as a result, they've been kicked out of the labyrinth proper. So maybe Didymus has been tricked because he doesn't seem to be the brightest, even though he's very chivalrous. And he's been told, guard this bridge that nobody is ever going to come to. And just stay here. And he's like, absolutely, I'll do this. I'll be very important. They're like, okay, good. This fucking idiot is out of here. We don't need to worry about this anymore.
Ambrosia! Yeah. Ambrosia! Get back here! Ambrosius.
Ambrosius, yeah. And then Ludo, who they seem to be a pretty simple, carefree creature. Don't seem to be hurting anything, but there's obviously potential for it because they are, one, massive. Two, they can summon fucking boulders to come destroy everything.
Yeah, I guess
small to medium-sized boulders.
Small to medium-sized, and maybe even a large one that crushed that poor individual with the Gatling gun and a literal cannon sticking out of their chest. And, you know, maybe if this creature doesn't have the highest level of intelligence, doesn't maybe understand certain concepts like jokes or sarcasm or, you know, harmless fun, and you piss it off, it's going to come in a boulder to crush you. And if you have other individuals that are seem to be pretty mischievous, fieries aside, you want to keep that person out of your society. So they're out. Hoggle seems to be a weird gray area there where maybe he seems to have committed some slight against the colony or this interspecific society group. And so he's been given a chance to come back into Jareth's good graces by tricking Sarah, but he seems to go further and further down that rabbit hole of doing bad things. So Jareth is now working against him as well. So that's kind of like the way I'm seeing this working. As far as how this would evolve, it would be immensely complicated. You would have to have simultaneous selection acting on all these different individuals to work out in a way that there's benefit to working with other species, potentially, to maybe not reproducing as much yourself, but benefiting Jareth, who seems to be this individual that's in charge of everything and maybe is the only one reproducing, which doesn't quite make sense. Because you have a thing called kin selection in ecology, where the aunts and uncles of birds, for example, will take care of their nieces and nephews because their sister or brother, I'm using these human terms to make this a bit easier, their offspring share some of the genes that this aunt or uncle does. So by helping out their niece or nephew, some of their genetic material they share is being passed on. So it benefits them somewhat to try and help take care of these. And that's called kin selection. there's a lot of debate going on there whether there's true altruism in nature, because to me, I doubt it. It doesn't make sense. It would be pretty heavily selected against or taken advantage of by other organisms. But that seems to be what's going on here, and I'm not quite sure of the mechanism, but it's what I got.
I do like the concept that Adam brings up of Jareth being the reproducing unit of the colony, and he's just going off and he's just banging various housewives and then showing up a couple years later to collect his illegitimate children. And this is just basically the collection that he's making up. It's just Bowie's going out into the world and he's like, actually, this is mine. This is mine.
So as far as, like I said, I don't know what kind of selection or process would have led to this, but there must be something that Jareth, him or themselves, is providing to this entire society where he is allowed to reign supreme. He seems to be directing everything, in charge of things. I'm saying he because he seems to be a he in the movie, but we don't know. Maybe there's a weird queen thing going on, like Sam mentioned. But
yeah,
he might be from a species, another hominid that is similar to humans, and maybe he himself is confused by the appearance of Toby, and maybe his instincts kick in, and he thinks, oh, you know, this is one of mine, so I'm going to abduct Toby, and raise him as my own, and he can continue the line. But long story short, I think there is something crazy to this world of the goblins, where there's some kind of crazy dangerous predator or competitor that lives outside of the labyrinth. By working within it, all of these species can then succeed and increase their fitness by having this shielded, protected, confusing labyrinth to live within and keep everything else out.
Maybe it's Ludo's species, because he's the one that we see them hunting and trying to, you know, capture and kill him. And Ludo is just like the dumb version. Like, he just happened to be like the dumb, and there's like smarter, more dangerous Ludos.
Maybe.
I would be interested in watching Ludo eat a goblin off screen.
He's got the mouth for it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
King Shark and Suicide Squad just nom nom nom.
I want to know the ecological pathway that leads to a parasite becoming a man's hat. That's what I wanted to know.
I do love that.
I think that guy just really liked his pet and wants it on his head at all times.
Yeah, that's a fair point.
It's like a parrot on your shoulder. This guy is going for a whole ass stalk on his head.
Oh, it's so stimulating being your head.
So let's talk puppets. Basically, I kind of wanted to do a little bit more of a history lesson, because I am not a huge fan of puppets, but I don't know a lot about them. So I wanted to talk about kind of, from a story perspective, what puppetry is and what it was used for over the course of human history. So simple puppetry is an ancient form of theater, exactly how you would think, that it's used to illustrate, entertain, and perform stories, rituals, dances to an audience. It was often used to convey ideas or new concepts to rural areas that didn't have access to full playhouses, shows, or theaters. So it's sort of like a cheap and easy way to have a play and travel it all around your country or land area and convey sort of new rules or new ideas to the masses, which I found was interesting. I always just thought it was just pure performance.
Cool. Was this like a quick question on that? Was this like an intentional thing as far as they were deliberately trying to instill a message, or was it kind of like maybe a comedian or a musician having a political take on something?
Both. And some of them were just pure performance, just for entertainment. It was both. I think more the former than the latter. I think it was more used to sort of convey new ways of thinking that was like sort of sweeping the whatever big cities were in the area at the time, or towns. So simple puppets include finger puppets, sock puppets, masks are also considered puppets, hand or glove puppets. So those are pretty limited movements, you know, one puppeteer controlling them, that type of thing. More complicated puppets include marionettes, which we know are sort of, think Pinocchio with the strings and the rod, and or larger glove puppets, which require multiple puppeteers to control. So Japanese bunraku puppets are an example of this. I'm going to mispronounce all these, so I apologize. And as well as some of Henson's creations, so i.e. Hoggle, which was on the set the most complex puppet in Labyrinth, and it took 3 puppeteers to operate.
And it shows.
Yeah, so for Hoggle, they had a person inside the puppet. They had a person controlling, I think it was like limited hand movements or something. And then Brian Henson, Jim Henson's son, was radio controlling Hoggle's facial movements.
Wow.
It was a family affair. It's always what I like about Labyrinth. There were multiple Hensons on there.
Mm-hmm. So in history, over the globe, I just kind of wanted to touch on different countries and like what they used and why. Just a very, very, very brief overview. I'm not going to go country by country, but just sort of regional across the world. So Africa, they use masks and puppets for healing and hunting rituals. East Asia, there's a ton in East Asia. But I wanted to read this quote just because I found this very fascinating. So Vietnam actually developed the art form of water puppetry, which I've never heard of before.
It's so cool. I've been to some water puppet shows in Vietnam. It's amazing.
Have you? Yeah. That's so awesome. Yeah, so the puppets are built out of wood and the shows are performed in a waist-high pool. So a large rod under the water is used by the puppeteers to support and control the puppets, creating the appearance of the puppets moving over water. So the origin of this form of puppetry dates back 700 years when the rice fields would flood and villagers would entertain each other. Puppet show competitions between Vietnamese villages eventually led to the creation of secretive and exclusive puppet societies, which I found fascinating. Yeah.
In Hanoi, they actually have a water puppet theater that mm-hmm. you can go to. They have shows every night. It's incredible. If anybody is ever lucky enough to go to Hanoi, absolutely recommend doing it. And buy yourself a water puppet, because they're really, really cool.
That's really neat.
Nice. Yeah.
So in West Asia, the Ottoman Empire and Mongols via China to Turkey gave Middle East a variety of mostly shadow puppetry forms. Europe, marionettes abound, as we have seen, and also the traditional small window two puppet shows that we so often think of or see in like medieval TV or cinema, where it's like two people with, you know,
club bonking each other on the head.
Clubbing each other. Yeah, the classic puppet thing that you think of. So that's actually a 16th century Italian form. That's where it came from, called Commedia dell'arte, or art. I don't know how to pronounce it. Again, apologies. In North American, the Teotihuacan culture of central Mexico of 600 AD is made of figurines with movable arms and legs as part of their funerary rites. And then indigenous Americans also use ceremonial puppets. Australia, Aboriginal peoples use masks and puppets to supplement their long-standing tradition of oral storytelling. So notable puppets over the years, Muppets, obviously, Lamb Chop, Sesame Street, Punch and Judy, Howdy Doody, and Yoda.
Also, the construction of the Yoda puppet was so interesting because it was like that weird silica exterior to it that made it look like very like skin-like and real. But from my understanding of it, that material decays in a very specific way, like from the inside out. So basically, like now if you touch it, the whole thing will fall apart.
Interesting. I wanted to ask y'all, so I want you to give a guess at what time period in the history of the world do we know that puppetry was first used, and where in the world was it first used?
3,500 years ago in Mesopotamia.
So it is 5th century BC in ancient Greece.
Cool. I thought it would have been older.
Yeah.
And then they have a date that they think that it may have originated, but there's no like real concrete evidence. Like all they found are basically these remnants of these doll-esque things that can knead flour, but they're not sure what it was used for. So that's sort of like a guess that it might have been a puppet, and that is as long ago as 3,000 years BC.
Holy crap.
And then the only other thing I was going to say, which I thought was really cool, was Jim Henson, who we all know is super famous puppeteer. He created a foundation that develops and continues the tradition of puppetry and has currently bestowed over 400 grants to puppeteer artists to sort of keep that tradition alive, which is neat.
It's really cool. Mm-hmm.
Do we know when the first sock puppet was used?
When was the first sock made? That day. I've got this sock.
Yeah.
Or...
Oh, yeah.
I've got a snake.
And when those googly eyes came into production, God. Things just mm-hmm. took off. Yeah.
You guys have no idea how common it is behind closed doors for if we have a kitten or a puppy come in to go into the back and find a tech holding it and standing it up on its legs and going like, I'm just a cute little puppy. Here I go. I'm running around. And you're like, yeah, humans will just, they'll puppet whatever they can puppet, man.
Sounds about right.
I'll do funny things if you want me to. I'm your puppet.
So, would we recommend this movie?
Absolutely.
Yeah, no. 100%. I love this movie.
I think this movie would be fun if you were tripping balls and wanted to go down some hellish hellscape.
As I said in the Discord chat, I think this movie would be best viewed through a thin veil of nostalgia and a thicker veil of alcohol.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think, yeah, I mean, I really enjoyed this movie. And I think that it's one of those ones that it's not necessary, but it's like an important cultural touchstone movie, especially for that time period. So growing up with people like hearing movies or podcasts or references by people that were, you know, 10, 15 years older than me, it's one of those things that they will bring up a lot. And I've never seen Dark Crystal, so that's another one that gets brought up a lot. But
so good.
Yeah, I don't plan on it. But I think it's an interesting, from, if nothing else, a historical perspective.
Do we feel sorry for any of the monsters?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, the goblins feel heavily abused, fairly broken, and rewatching this and realizing the idea that these might be brainwashed children, the idea of her smashing glass bottles on their head when they're trying to get into the little house that they're shielding in, it gets a lot darker.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. And even with the fieries, she's ripping their heads off and like throwing them away.
Without their consent.
She's a monster. Yeah.
Yeah.
You can rip off your own head, but you can't rip off somebody else's head.
I don't really feel bad for any of these monsters. And I think it's because this movie is so slapstick, but it's like a slapstick cartoon where anything can happen. Limbs can fall off. People can get smashed with a hammer, turn into a pancake, and pop right back up. That's what this world seems like. So it doesn't really seem like there's any real consequences to any of this. So I don't really feel bad for any of them.
I definitely feel bad for Ambrosius, the poor scared dog trapped in the middle of this as people keep screaming at him to run into the foray of
actual
spears
dog.
And gunfire.
Yeah.
I absolutely love that half the time it was a puppet and half the time it was a real dog. I found that hilarious.
When it's like poking out from behind the stone and all of a sudden it's a puppet, I'm like, well, this took a turn.
And they don't explain it. Like, it's just great.
Yeah. Just like, was I not looking before? Was I just...
I will say I am disappointed that none of us used a pun about this movie being amazing.
That's pretty good, eh?
And I just want to point out, Adam and I have not sung Bo is in Space once, okay?
You did.
Yeah, you did.
I did it once, but I'll cut that out.
But keep that part in.
Bo is in Space.
Big week next week with New York Times bestselling author Scott Sigler to come talk with us, probably a little bit about his own book, his Infected series, but then Slither is the movie we're going to be focusing on. After touching on it briefly in our Four Parasites and a Dissertation episode, we're going to be going for a more in-depth look at this wonderfully disgusting movie.
My plan is to slowly add authors and storytellers, so now the scientists become outnumbered.
So yeah, next week's Slither, and as you see at the end of every episode, the monsters aren't real, but the science is. And David Bowie's magical.
Bye-bye, guys.
Bye.
TriStar Pictures announces the collaboration of three extraordinary talents. Jim Henson, creator of The Muppets and Dark Crystal. George Lucas, creator of the Star Wars saga. And one of the most innovative forces in modern entertainment, David Bowie. Together, they will take you into a dazzling world of fantasy and adventure. The world of Labyrinth.